This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Daniela. My guest today is the lovely and amazing Arnaldo J. Lopez. He's one of the people that I think is brilliant, amazing. He's very humble, and he's cringing as I say these words. But I admire him, and I respect his thinking and profound thoughts and inquiries about culture and race and people and humanity. And I talk to him about a whole bunch of things. So today I want to focus on talking about the administration, I guess, of culture and how do artists administer themselves. We'll navigate a little bit about that in the realm of the not-for-profit sector, but we could talk about the profit sector as well. And then we were just talking before going live about individual artists and collectives and theater companies and how they play for and against one another in this new landscape changing. Also, I want to say that Arnaldo serves presently as a development officer of Pregones Puerto Rican Traveling Theater, an organization close to our heart. And we can talk about that in another podcast. But for now, thank you for being here with me.
Gracias. So I'm delighted to be here. I've had the pleasure of sitting down to take in the notes from a Native daughter. It's great to be part of this growing conversation, which I think is vital.
I think so, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's so many amazing people and good conversations to have. The concern that I have is how is it all changing? And I'm talking about myself as a 46-year-old that lives in a analog reality and a technology reality. And I think, you know, and this is in general terms, but I think it translates into everything, right? Theater, music, dance, and how are we existing and trying to live with these two realities and making sense of that.
I think that we tend to more often think that we are creatures of habit, but the truth is that we are consistently creatures of change. And it's important to be able to shuttle between those two realities and not necessarily see them as binary opposition, but as things that happen simultaneously. So there's a lot of porous space. And I think this is true of the arts field in general and of doing cultural work. So, you know, just as an entry point, last year I started introducing fundraising workshops that I present by throwing on the screen one of these visualizations of complexity. Are you familiar? This is a growing field. I don't think it's entirely new anymore, but it's become increasingly popular. So there are ways in which complex data can be visualized, and the images tend to be immensely dense. So you may have waves or lines that interconnect, and it looks like abstract art. What I was interested in is the idea that our societies, our present moment in the world is really of immense complexity, and that density is also something that you can look closely at and find roots and patterns. So there's a sense of this thing that is almost untractable, and there's also the sense that if you pause, you will be able to find a number of points where you have to agree to go on or disagree. Mm-hmm. So there are moments of choice that build this complexity. And in as much as we are creatures of habit, I think that we become blind to the kinds of pressures and demands that build the habit. And this is true in the arts field as in any other. The need to, for example, fundraise and make sure that your budget meets the needs of the projects that you are holding is key. But how to break it down, how to look at the pieces that help you navigate a complexity to really get to the outcome that you want. So I'm fascinated by this relationship between being immersed in almost coercive systems of engagement. I'm fascinated by the fact that these complexities are different from one field to another and also create a kind of silo effect where people tend to complain about being isolated from their peers or from folks that they admire or from sectors that they admire. I'm interested in the fact that just by looking askew, just by like looking sideways or by pausing and looking more carefully, you can also see that there are ways into the complexity and that you can choose to focus on certain aspects of it. And that's the space of mastery and achievement. And is also the space of change, because at the end of the day, being able to accept or choose not to accept is also an opportunity to introduce a variable. Mm. So change in that sense.
And artists are adept at change more than other people, do you think?
Artists that are
trying to find a life for themselves in this milieu.
I want to say that there are artists who are very nimble and there are artists who aren't, and this does not speak one way or another to their talents. They can each be immensely talented. Some artists find a way to fit into a system that's already running. So when we think of somebody who succeeds, quote unquote, easily in a place like Hollywood, we're talking about somebody who can really sort of show up to a complexity that's already running and in place versus somebody who really has to crack their way through. These are cliches, but these are cliches that are really based in observations that are true. So that's why people continue to mull them over. I want to say that, on the other hand, without having to romanticize the kinds of openings that the arts can create for anybody, it is true that for artists who are in contact with each other and have to engage some kind of participant, audience, that really changes your outlook. That really demands that you wear sort of multiple perspectives, that you're able to stand in different shoes, and that's a big asset.
Meaning the theater companies that are around the nation,
right,
that are not,
right,
Broadway, that are,
right,
not Hollywood. When it's not Hollywood, then, one, what are we, right? Like, what is it?
Yeah.
And what this art machine that, you know, if it's not Hollywood or Broadway, then what is it? And it exists in this fringe,
mm-hmm,
and yet it's very active.
Yeah.
And I think I hear this new generation trying to make sense of it,
yeah.
And there's a new language, I feel like, that,
yeah,
I'm hearing new words, not, of course, words that I know, but in relation to the field, in relation to how they're creating new works,
yeah,
or what kind of works are being put out. And is that different, or is that part of that change?
I think it's a little bit of both. And I have to sort of be frank and say that I almost prefer to talk about this by circumlocution, which is going around it, mm-hmm, rather than addressing it directly. We can address it directly in a number of ways, of course. We can talk nonprofit. We can talk mission, programs, governance, fundraising. evaluations, outcomes. These are all pretty standard, and there's ways to look at them also with fresh eyes. But I prefer to look at it in this sort of circumlocution because really I feel that we are living in a transitional moment, and the transitional is roughly borrowing from the way Jeremy Rifkin has presented it as a transition from capitalism to something else that is a recovery and reinvention of the commons. So I think that that's a valuable proposition for us to hang our coat on at this particular moment. I'm open to others, and I actually enjoy seeing the ways in which people are grappling and conceptualizing where we're at. But when you look at, for instance, funding for the arts, in the last few years, we've seen an incredible kind of validation of the work that this quote-unquote fringe has been doing for decades. So the nonprofit theater, the grassroots community-based, culturally specific theater companies in this country, Latino theater companies, African-American theater companies, Asian theater companies, poor white Appalachian theater companies. And they have been doing work that is specifically geared towards being in authentic dialogue with place and with the people who live and make place. And in the last few years, the validation of some of those principles, which have histories and are complex and are rich and fascinating and do not really circulate in any equitable way and are rarely credited to older sources. So it's a charged sort of dialogue and landscape. So that validation translates into an interest on the part of public and private philanthropy that has crystallized around the notion of creative placemaking, for example. And that investment has also taken those ideas in new, exciting, different directions and certainly different scale. And scale is also, another complexity that we have to meet. What does it mean to have the resources to do something that engages a large number of people? What does it mean when the work that you do engages a smaller group of people? So we don't have to judge. It's not a matter of saying bigger is better. But there are also considerations that we ought to have around what is scale and who invests and who gets to do projects at scale. The work that is widely recognized. Companies doing theater work that are immediately recognized by people of different background, different heritage, versus companies that are dear and near to specific communities or in specific sectors. The arts field is also a complexity, right? So that, you see dominant sectors within that complexity. And you see, other areas that have presence that is different. We tend to hierarchize the way that we talk about this, but that's not necessary. And I think we're seeing a flipping of that. So that there is, as much as there is recognition of what the fringe has been doing, we see artists who do work that is based in community or that comes out of grassroots, community-based, culturally specific work, wanting to validate that and wanting to aggregate their tools and their resources, I'm tempted to say, to meet scale from a different perspective and, you know, from a different route.
You mean, but it's also because the artist needs to start somewhere.
Yeah, and they do, and they do. So again, you know, you have artists. The professionalization of our field is a big factor, and there are vetted ways in which people can acquire a skill set that makes them a professional artist, and there are other ways in which people acquire the skills that make them a professional artist. The meeting point and who does the vetting, right? That's part of
Who does the vetting?
It depends on what stage you want to be on, right? If you want to be on a Broadway stage, you have to go to an audition. You know, you're likely to work with an agent. And there's a number of steps that go in the direction of making you a viable candidate. When we're working about community-based theater, that vetting is done differently, and may require different kinds of abilities and different ways of showing, yes, I can do this, or I'm ready to learn it. So you know.
So, and some of the tension that is occurring between artists choosing to become or stay either a collective, a for-profit venture, work within that type of structure, rather than following the established norm for the most part up to now, from the 1965 to like now, in the structure of administration. Is it different? Is it becoming something else? Or how is it changing?
From the administrative perspective? So I think in some ways, you know, what I've been saying is also the case for arts management. So there are a lot of people doing arts management that learned their trade on the job. And this happened up to maybe the 90s when more programs that were specifically preparing people to do arts management were coming, you know, were acquiring BAs and graduate degrees and then going to the, you know, looking for positions in arts management. There's also, I think, a long history of people studying business coming to arts management, and arts management, you know, is a distinguished field with its own history, and theater management in particular, I think, has led to a number of proven standards because of resourcing. Not all companies will adhere to a standard structure for arts administration. And you get a lot of projects that are driven by the will of the artist that founded them. This doesn't make them lesser projects. It makes them different projects. And in many cases, there are lessons that the larger field, the field at large, can draw from coming out of these other models, right? So again, this idea that there are multiple sectors in the professional theater, and that scale plays a role, and then the ability to run them really generates different kinds of leadership and different kinds of making things work. So I think it's really important to see that the complexity has value, right? The complexity of a field, when we want to recognize it, it's not about simplifying it. So when I say you can zoom in, I'm just saying let's make it easier on the individual who has the task to make X project move forward. Let's make the complexity, let's zoom in so that the person can, with more ease, master their area. But the plurality of things is in itself a value. I see a lot of organizations that yearn to have bigger staff because the what they really want is the resources that come with it. But growing that capacity, that's a very individual path that each organization has to pursue. What I don't see happening often enough is either the recognition of the field as a complexity, of the role of the company in that complexity, and a kind of deep inventory of the assets that are already in place. So that's like my first go-to. When I work working in my theater or visiting other companies, my first invitation when it's the moment for planning is, can we take a really good look at what's being done? What are the skill sets that have already been developed here?
But something in there you talked about what is, chosen or as complexity in terms of content. Let's just say, in terms of the art itself, in relation to the complexities of arts administration, is there a tension between content and administering? And also, like, the outside, whoever is doing the vetting, like, the narratives or the acknowledgement of that lush part of the artistic enterprise, does it get acknowledged enough or not, and why? And is that just the same argument or the same conversation when you discuss in other areas where history sort of is... ignored or made to not be important? I'm talking about, community theaters, that are, what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Finding our way in, etching our place in this narrative of theater, American theater.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me suggest this much. People of color, people who work from the vantage of something that is either place-based or community-based, culturally specific, are often at odds with certain expectations that are established in the field. I'm not so sure I don't think it really generates a conflict between the resourcing and the administration of the resources and the form and content. But there are ways in which the form and content that are deeply rooted are not recognized in the market, right? So there are dominant ways of looking at things that tend to be simplified. There's much of value in these platforms of scale, like Hollywood and Broadway. I mean, these are important contributions to culture that have tremendous power to disseminate ideas, aesthetics, and ways that really enrich and can propel forward society. There's also much that gets lost when the lens is that particular lens. So what companies like the ones that we are talking belonging to the fringe do their work, they also do a tremendous amount of additional education to the world. They educate the audience. They educate the artists that come to work for them. They educate the grant makers who invest to see that vision move forward. They educate the patron and the donor. So it's important to see that this work has its own additional demands. You have to meet, in some ways, the vetting of the field, understanding that your quote-unquote product is not going to meet all of the demands because the lens doesn't necessarily allow them to see what you're doing. So you have to help shape that. We're in a fantastic moment because it's been decades of doing that. Mm-hmm. Decades of that, dialogue. A dialogue that has been full of disappointment and also full of successes. It's a mix. And today we have a much better informed general audience, a much better informed philanthropic sector, a much better informed artist base, and a much better informed, I think, cadre of arts managers, some of whom trained formally, some of whom learned on the job, and networks, right? We have networks now that are stronger and more keenly aware of these ins and outs than we did before. Mm-hmm. When we talk about Latino arts, I think of the National Association of Latino Arts and Culture as one of those networks. You know, and there we're talking about a national network, people throughout the nation with different perspectives on the different artistic genres and the fields and the disciplines, the ways they interconnect, who they serve and why, and being able to aggregate. Right, we are today in a better position to aggregate, which is why we are baffled at the political landscape. Right, we're baffled at this particular turn in the federal government. We're also not without resource, not without options, and also baffled and upset, but not entirely surprised, I hope, because I think that, you know, we've seen this in a number of shapes, and we've helped put it in place before, and we have to continue to do that. So education, right? Education.
So it becomes that our voices are more important than ever.
It is. It's absolutely true. I think that our voices are more important than ever. Our ability to talk to each other is more important than ever, which is another reason why the idea of the commons is translating into real practice, right? Creating platforms where people don't have to address capital demands at the top of the list, right? How, you know, pooling resources, collaboration. I am fortunate that I work with a group of artists that is a colectivo, an ensemble, right? So they're both historically grounded in Caribbean and Latin American practice, a kind of theater that is wants to be daring and that wants to be accessible at the same time, and that has a frank commitment to stay relevant and political and open. So I think that it's amazing to see that even 10 years ago, you know, the kinds of care that I would have to put into articulating that was different from today. Today, there's more recognition immediate recognition that that is a value. There's, you know, the we are seeing a revolution in terms of how our sector organizes and works. And I'm thinking of things like the Latino Theater Commons and HowlRound. But I'm also thinking that there are ways in which that happens even locally. So, you know, you take the for decades, that's been the modus operandi. And now we feel we're both being recognized and maybe co-opted, right? So there's also a sense of how do we continue to thrive, continue to grow our perspectives and our ways of working, and at the same time, make sure that this isn't simply a gentrification of our modes of work, right?
Yeah. And
Let me add that I hear this articulated a lot by Latino theater artists, so actors and musicians who shuttle from auditions at either large nonprofit regional theaters or who audition a Broadway regional theater and the mid-size and small theaters. Mm-hmm. So those people, those individuals are often having to sort of readjust their place in the complexity of the professional theater. Right, because they are not seen and they don't have the same agency when they are standing at audition for a Broadway premiere, mm-hmm. than when they are, standing either at audition or by invitation to be part of a cast and maybe be the have a starring role at one of their. You know, at a stage that they perceive as one of their own, right? Home.
Yeah, I know. So I wanted. No, I know a lot of these artists.
Uh huh.
You know, they're. I admire them.
Me too, immensely. And I learn from them. Mm-hmm. Listening and learning have a big part in our ability to move this forward.
Yeah, and. What about this very saturated, or it feels like it, this is what I hear from the chatter, the saturated philanthropic sector. And I hear this, and then I read, let's say, job postings for cultural organizations, mid-size or some very well-established organizations or... And this standard of what this executive individual has mm-hmm. to achieve, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's astounding, really.
Yes. Wow, who is this incredible person, right? In relation
to this very saturated philanthropic sector, and then how do you marry those two things and all these people doing the same thing, doing the same prescription... Right. This is the way to earn money. This is the way to do it. Is it the only way to earn money? Is it the only way to do it? And I'm not just talking about our theater. I'm, you know, in general.
Sure. I hear you.
People are running away, right, from it.
Yeah, and rightfully so, I think, in some instances. So we are at that place where... the American dream breaks down. Mm-hmm. And I say it, and I say it to people near me in different contexts, and that statement, which is also a kind of cliche, is met with a real uncomfortable response. Like, even people who I know a lot more than me will cringe a little because this is part of that habit, right? This is the idea that there is a making it is huge. and continues to be huge, and we are at that moment when that has to be adjusted for so many reasons that intersect with the theater. And well, it's a fact that more than ever before, we're talking about connections across sectors, connections across points of interest, and realities coming to a head, right? So we can't talk about theater without talking about the environment, for instance, because the breaking down of the American dream is also the recognition of a system that squeezes value out of everything in the planet to the point where the planet isn't the bounty of life that that we want to continue to think it is without end, right? So there is an end. And you know, that is also, another conversation. But when we talk about standards and ways of achieving the dream, one common narrative is your parents go out of their way so you can have it a little better. And having it a little better has to do with acquiring at least one college degree, hopefully two. I think starting in the 80s, that master's was like important. And nowadays, it's not uncommon to want an additional certification or a third degree or its equivalent, whether it's a fellowship or some other kind of recognition and vetting, right, at the educational point that will prepare you. And I think for certain sectors of our society, the idea is that it entitles you to a really good job. We have really noxious idea of what a really good job is, because it's supposed to be a very high-paying job that somehow hits magically on your sweet spot of enjoyment, and that you're gonna, you know, love to live that life, right? You know, it's just gonna drive you, and you're gonna drive it. And we use all kinds of also noxious language, you know, to talk about making a killing at it or being on top of it. So I think that that narrative becomes harder and harder for people to get. You know, to get a ride that way, to ride it. I think that it's less and less the case that those things play out, and we see, for instance, versions of the narrative that are also now very common, such as your parents worked really hard so you could have it a little better. You went to get your degree at tremendous cost. You may or may not be able to get that master's, and if you do, you take on additional debt, and then you go out to a job market that is not able to take you in the way that will create the kinds of stability that you anticipated, which included paying off that debt and getting onto other choice debt, such as a mortgage. So that American dream, and that's just, you know, one simplification. We could do others that are equally or more colorful. But the point is that out of necessity, as much as out of self-respect, we are looking at the alternatives. So people who go into graduate programs, undergraduate and graduate programs for arts management, they want to work at a place that is somehow closer to the dream, right? So, oh my God, I really want that job at Lincoln Center. The reality of the job at Lincoln Center may not be at all like like the dream, except for a handful of people. So there is such a thing as an elite circuit, and that's what you constantly see at the, you know, there's contention about the city of New York made some inquiries into diversity and realized that at the top tiers of management, there's no diversity to speak of, right? So these organizations are being diversified, if at all, from the bottom up. So think about that. You know, what does that say in terms of accessing that dream for people who are bright and capable and fresh from their preparation? Right?
Yeah.
So you know, in light of that, there is this validation of the alternate routes. Yeah. And the alternate routes can be a mix of the traditional narrative with something else. So maybe somebody doesn't take on that master's, but they did some work in the theater department at their school, and then they shadowed somebody at a smaller organization and in the job they learn.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe they choose to not do a degree at all. And I think that they're still at a disadvantage.
Sure.
This is so big, speaking as a Puerto Riqueño, mm-hmm. And as a Puerto Riqueño in the United States. I mean, I've been here most of my life. There are two big sort of looming ideologies that I think are so important, have played such a big role. One is aesthetic, right? So there's an idea, and I think that Puerto Rico is not alone. This is something that plays out in the Caribbean and Latin America. So aesthetic ideology, this idea that there's something about the artistic vision and the arts and the humanities that can really lift us. In Puerto Rico, it plays out in very particular ways because in the absence of a clear political identity, cultural nationalism, you know, is a real important contribution to the world. And then there's educational ideology, which is the idea that a good education will also lift us. And the moment in which capitalism puts a lock on that because of these inequities that we've been, that are implicit in this conversation, then where do you go? So, you know, we have to be inventive both about how we draw and contribute to the arts and to aesthetic impulse, and we have to be inventive about the ways in which we educate ourselves, educate others, and again, being in a role where someone else doesn't have to think about this, and I may have to sit across the table from them. That means that I have to do my job that I came to do at the table, and I also have to educate them. In whichever, you know, whatever skills I have and that are germane, as to this difference and this additional care that I have to put into this, that's the relationship often of our organizations, our people of color, community-based, culturally specific organizations and individuals working in arts and culture seeking investment. So you know, coming back to the idea of philanthropy, there are many there are many values in philanthropy that I think are sustained. I think that all of these recognitions of the fringe and trying to learn from that, this is enriching philanthropy. This is why I think it's even though it's still far from Equitable. It's a better place. All of these complexities, not all of them connect, right? Not all the threads will connect, and that's okay. I want to find better ways to listen. When I was in college, I used to write out these thoughts in calligraphy and put it in my friends' fridges. And I remember one that said, "It takes all kinds." That was the thought. It takes all kinds, right? Generic enough, inspirational enough, but hard reality to come to grips with, because at the end of the day, I'd be the first one to stand in the proverbial picket line to say, not all kinds, but it takes all kinds of those who can contribute towards making this livable,
yeah.
Right? And that's where, you know, also we get to learn every time, because, you know, I didn't think of the Native Mexican woman who moved to the Bronx to open a restaurant, you know. But then I met her, right?
Yeah.
So I have to make room for that.
Yeah.
and like that, literally more examples than we can count. So remaining, keeping that circle open, right?
Yeah. This is beautiful.
Yeah.
Being open.
Yeah.
Your heart must be open. Wait. How does Madonna say? Your heart's not open. I had to say, no. You know that song? Oh, my God. Your heart's not open. The Power of Goodbye.
Okay.
That's a whole different thing. Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
You know, Madge.
All
Madge
right.
Moment.
Yes. We'll leave our conversation there for today.
Well, thank you.
Next time, in a few months, we'll... I'll hand you like a little outline, and we'll talk about some specific topics.
Sure.
About arts and culture and living it up.
Sounds good.
Gracias.
Gracias a ti.